Welcome to Cattle HQ, brought to you by South Dakota State University Extension. I am Robin Salverson, cow-calf field specialist based out of Lemon, and along with me, we have a very familiar voice, Kiernan Brandt. Kiernan, why don't you say hi?
Hey, good morning. Yeah, this is Kiernan Brandt, cow-calf field specialist out of the Watertown Regional Office.
We are going to be your host for this episode. We have Dr. Trey Patterson, the CEO and president of the Padlock Ranch near Ranchester, Wyoming. We're excited to pick Trey's brain about the Padlock Ranch, their philosophy at the ranch, and maybe dive a bit deeper into their heifer development program. So with that, we're just going to go ahead and get started. So Trey, can you share with the audience maybe a bit more about yourself and also the Padlock Ranch for those that maybe don't know about the Padlock Ranch?
Sure, it's great to be with you today and have a conversation about ranching. I get passionate about a lot of this stuff, so it's going to be exciting to talk to you about that. And former career, I was an extension beef specialist with South Dakota State University based out of Rapid City, out of the West River Ag Center, and sincerely enjoyed my time in South Dakota and getting to know the producers in the state, and what a great state you guys get to live in. That's awesome, and some great production systems. I think I learned more in my time at SDSU in the 5 years I was there, just working with ranchers throughout the state, than I probably taught anybody. But I've been with Padlock for about 16 years, and I've been in this role as the CEO since 2014. Padlock Ranch is a family owned business. It was started in the early 1940s, fairly small beginnings, and grew over time. We ranch in Sheridan County, Wyoming, and Bighorn County, Montana. The ranch has grown significantly since its origins, both with land acquisitions and with leases. Our footprint's been fairly stable for the last 30 years or so. Little bit of changes, but not a lot of growth in that period of time. But we operate a diversified cow-calf farming and feedlot operation. We run on a little over 400,000 acres in those two counties, and have a commercial crossbred cow-calf herd. And that's really the foundation of the ranching enterprise. We also have a grow yard just north of Dayton, Wyoming, and we are finishing some cattle in that feed yard. And so we'll fill that up with our home-raised calves in the fall of the year, and then sell yearlings in the following spring, or retain ownership on the cattle and feed them here for a few different programs that we feed for. The farming enterprise goes to support the forage needs of the ranch and the feedlot. And, you know, in a good year, we put up enough hay to supply most, if not all, the hay needs for the cow-calf operation and the yard. On a tough year like we're in right now, where it's been extremely dry, we have to support that some. We put up a fairly large crop of corn silage and haylage that we use in the feedlot for growing calves, but also for adding value to cull cows. You know, our system is built around trying to add value to everything that's leaving the place. And so we're pretty intentional and calculated about how we use those feed resources to turn those into profit. The cow-calf enterprise is fairly extensive, meaning we don't have a lot of inputs. The cow-to-man ratio is fairly high compared to some operations. You know, we run about units of about 2,000 cows each, and each of those units will have 2 to 3 full-time people that work on those units, and try to keep costs, you know, as low as we can, and get a weaned calf that we can make some money with in the fall of the year. The feedlot and farming is more intensive, a lot more iron, a lot more labor. But we've calculated we can add profit to the ranch by utilizing those resources and diversifying marketing. So fairly fairly involved, integrated agribusiness, and full of challenges. So I look forward to talking to you guys today about some of the things we've learned and maybe some of the things we don't know.
Well, thank you, Trey. Actually, Trey and I started our career together here in South Dakota with Extension. So
yeah, that's right.
We actually got to go to graduate school together too. So that was always a pleasure to be able to connect with Trey again and visit, and always great to see him when we were at a meeting or something like that. So thank you, Trey, for joining us. And I'm just, Kiernan, do you have any questions right off?
I was not aware that Dr. Patterson was a CSU alumnus. I've heard that it's still unfortunate to be a CSU Ram.
Those are kind of fighting words.
For those that aren't aware, I did my undergrad at the University of Wyoming, so a bit of a cross-border rivalry for those not familiar with that geography. I was fortunate enough when I was younger to be able to see the Padlock Ranch a couple different times, and was just really impressed by how much emphasis you guys put on really tying things together and making it kind of fit the next step in the process, and making sure that everything kind of ties into that next step, which I think is a concept that some guys can get muddled with or confused with when they get kind of siloed into one specific aspect of their operation. And the focus of today's episode was going to be heifer development primarily, but I'd love to hear more about how you guys are adding value to your cull cows through some of that more intensive management with them, if you don't mind.
Oh, I'd be happy to share that. You know, and I think having the integration and the feed resources to allow us to do that has been really helpful. I don't think we often appreciate the importance of managing cow depreciation, which we can talk about some with the heifer development, but also the value of animals that are exiting the system. You know, can you think of many other businesses besides ranching where we turn over, 15% of our, producing assets every year replacements? You've got cows aging out and not breeding back and those type of things. And, there's a range around that, but that's an expensive venture. And so, kind of starting on the side of adding value, we really strive to keep a ratio, and it's a metric that we measure and track, where the value of cull cows leaving our system is at least 1-to-1 on what it cost us to add a new animal back to the system. And so that's really the metric, and it's influenced by markets, obviously, but marketing has an impact on that. And so we sort cows a lot, and we allocate a portion of our feed resources to add value. A few ways we do that is we will take our cows that are not bred in our season. We have about a 60-day breeding season, and cows that are not bred in that season continue to be exposed to bulls after the season. And we will, when we get all of those open cows put together in the fall of the year, and we've just now done that, it's quite the process for us to get all those put together, then we'll sort those, and those cows that are younger, say 8 or 9 years old or younger, and merchantable as bred cows, we will keep bulls in with them and feed them up, not to gain a lot of weight, but to add a little condition to them. And then we will preg test those out after the first of the year, and we'll have fall calving cows to market. So these will be younger bred cows. And we have repeat customers for those animals. And, you hear some people say, well, who would want to buy, somebody else's rebreeds? Well, I think a lot of times, these young cows come open because of management and sometimes environment or the interaction thereof. And you get those animals bred in a different season, and they they do really well. They get rebred again and again and again. And in fact, we've kept some of those, you know, a few occasions when we had the feed resources and cows that were calving. And so we calve in May and June, and cows that were calving in July and August, really more summer calvers that we kept, we were able to move 80% of those back into our season. And then they stay in there and make good cows. And so they are a merchantable animal. That's a market that you have to really kind of work at to find a home for those cows, but they're good quality young cows. And so then, right, you're selling a bred cow out in the spring of the year or the winter, depending on your timing, instead of an open cow in the fall. And the other thing is we look at that, you know, the usually fairly predictable seasonality of the colt cow market. Since most people wean and pregnancy test in the fall, that market, you know, is lower during that time of the year in October, November, into early December. And so we use our silage or corn silage and hay that we produce on the ranch to hold those cows over and sell those at a seasonally higher market out into February or March. And we also add some weight to them in that period of time. Now you have to calculate your feed cost and whether that's a paying proposition to do that, but usually it is, because that market really moves a lot from the November lows to, you know, the March highs, or a lot of times that high's not until April. We usually sell a little earlier than that, just managing our feed. But those are two ways that we add value to those colt cows. And we will, of course, cows that are aged out of the herd, what we'd call short-term cows, those are sorted off and sold as bred cows. And you can sell those at a more value than you can an open. And those, there's some real win-win scenarios with short-term cows. That's another set of cows that we will sometimes keep and run ourselves if we've got the feed resources. So we look at, you know, after we pregnancy test, how many cows do we have left, the producing cows, after we've gone through our normal culling protocols. And of course, one of the main things is culling for opens, but we may pick on some older cows. We'll look at what we have. If pregnancy rates are high in the fall, then we may not have room for those animals. So we're managing stocking rate on the ranch. Then we will sell those short-term cows. If the pregnancy rates are a little lower, or we cold more cows for other reasons, to keep our stocking rates optimal, we may decide to keep those. So we sell as many of those cows that leave our system bred as possible. And the ones that we do not think are as merchantable, or that there's a paying proposition for bringing them over as bred cows, we at least try to take those into a better market situation at a heavier weight. And so that we spend a lot of time with that. We sort cows a lot. And if you work here, I know some of the people may think we're crazy how much we sort on these cows, but it's a big deal and it adds value to the system. And of course, we have, you know, a bit of economy of scale with the number of cows that we're able to run doing that. But I think there's real opportunity for producers to partner with each other and put together packages of cows, you know, semi-load lots. So I think that's an important part of our system, Kiernan. And I think I appreciate you asking about it. It's fun to talk about, and I think we've had some success in doing that.
Well, and absolutely. And sorry, Robin, to hop over the top of you there. I've heard it said before that regardless of what sector you're in, as soon as bred females are brought into the equation, it's all a dispersal sale of sorts, whether that's in the purebred segment or the commercial segment. You know, there's reasons that we remove those females for culling decisions, but there's also reasons like what you just talked about that they just don't fit our system anymore. And there's no reason that that they can't be perfectly on time to go on and be productive in someone else's system. And I think you raise a lot of a lot of valid points about how we can do that strategically to partner up with each other. And especially if you've established some solid relationships with those fall bred cows, that's just a great way to capture some of that value that is potentially left on the table if you just were to market them as opens as soon as they don't fit into that 60-day window.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, from the customer relations side, I think if our customer can buy those cows maybe at a discount on what they could raise a new cow for as a replacement in their herd, or maybe compared to what they could go buy at a sale barn, if they can get a good value on them, and we can get a good value on them on what it, you know, over what the value was as a cull cow, plus our expenses, it does cost something to hold them over and breed them again and pregnancy test them again and all that. But I think it's really about creating win-win relationships in the marketplace. And that's what I think we really need to strive to do is find partners to be able to do that and really help each other out in terms of keeping this profitable. We have a pretty low margin business we're all in the cow-calf business, right? I mean, we have to do a lot of little things right to continually make money in this. And I think that's just one of the ways to do it.
Trey, so my question for you is you guys obviously have a large number of animals you're working with. But for producers that maybe don't have that number of animals, do you still see the value of them holding their cull cows? So, you know, a lot of what Western South Dakota is like, or across the state of South Dakota, for instance, and some of the producers there. What is your thought on smaller producers holding cull cows or adding value to those females like that?
I think there's still opportunity there. The concept is really still the same. And you know, if you've got the feed resources and labor to do that, it's at least worth putting a pencil to. And, you know, most of these production sales, as you get out into the late winter, spring of the year, you know, they have bred cow specials, and you may only have a horse trailer load. But, you know, those are packaged with buyers at the sale for those type of animals. So I think there's still opportunity there. There's also opportunity to find neighbors. And if you wanted to go the direct sell route and put together packages, you know, and to market, kind of combined together. So there are, you know, obviously, if you're going to ship the cows very far, you know, semi-load lots may become important. But I think there's ways to work around that. So I think those concepts still hold. And on, you know, on cows that you're just feeding, you know, looking at finding a different spot in the market to sell those where the market's better, you know, you can look back on historical data. CattleFax has really good historical data, and you can look at some averages, you know, and run the math on it. Say, boy, if I fed these cows for another 90 days, here's what I think it would cost to do that. You know, I think they'd be 80 or 100 pounds heavier, and here's the market differential. And so it's not too hard to run the arithmetic on that to see if it works for you. And it may not if your feed costs are really high, but I think there's money left on the table many times. So it's worth running the pencil on that and seeing if it works.
Thanks, Trey. So is there anything as you guys have gone through the last, you said you've been with Padlock for 16 years now, which kind of is unbelievable. But through that time that you've been with Padlock, as you said, you guys still focus on the bottom line. It's all about dollars and cents. And you said you have a small margin, just like all the rest of us within the cattle industry. But is there some things that you guys have tried that on the management side that maybe has failed that you want to have a conversation about, or maybe things that have been successful for you there at the Padlock Ranch?
Yeah, I think, you know, talk about the fun part first. I think the one of the things that has been really good for us is moving our calving season from March, April, more to May, June. And you hear a lot about calving season and their labor requirements. So, you know, all those things become considerations, but that has allowed us to winter out more cows because their requirements are lower during the wintertime, right? Because their requirements are increasing the further they get in gestation. And so we're calving on green grass. We were able to winter cows out a little longer. We're able to mix and match the stocking on the ranch with the resources. For instance, we have some areas of the ranch that are much better for winter grazing because of water quantity and quality issues than they are for summer grazing. And so calving a little later allows us to go winter cows in those areas and get them moved back to where we want to calve them at in the summertime. We have less feed inputs in them in the winter. So that May calving has been really good. The other thing that has been really a game changer is being able to calve the cows on green grass in May and really not have any calving labor, added labor and strain of calving. And these cows they calve really well on their own. And even first calf heifers, we breed those to Wagyu bulls. We have a market pre-established for those F1 Wagyu offspring. And we range calve those in May. And so all of our calving barns have been shuttered for years. And so calving is kind of a non-issue. And we're still able to wean a really good calf crop doing that. So it's been a cost savings making that move. That's worked really well. You know, the other thing that we use is a planned time-controlled grazing. So we're moving cattle around versus season-long grazing, running them in little larger bunches, and sometimes that's adding cows to a management group, or sometimes it's cross-fencing or both. But being able to manage the timing and duration of grazing has had, you know, pretty marked impacts on our carrying capacity. And I think we are more tolerant to drought. And man, we are in a tough drought right now. And we're affected just like everybody else. But I think maybe not as much as some, because we're trying to give those plants time to rest during what I would call the effective growing season. And, you know, we talk about our growing season kind of freeze, but, you know, in our part of the world, what I think is the effective period of time is when those plants are have some vegetation and can, you know, have photosynthesis going on when they're green. We've got the moisture to support some plant growth. And so for us, you know, that's May and June, really, sometimes in early July. But we're really wanting to rest pasture at some point during that period of time. And you're letting the factory, you know, what you see above the ground, do its job and take nutrients and put them back into the soil, like, you know, particularly carbon. And so we're trying to manage our rotational grazing, and we run some yearlings on a management intensive grazing where they're, you know, they're moved on irrigated pasture, moved daily or every other day. But our cows were not near that intensive. Some people are. Some people are better at it than we are. We felt like with our labor and our pasture size and really water limitations, we've decided not to get that intensive with the cows. But we are making sure that those pastures have time to rest during the year. And I think what we've seen, we've been able to document this, is we're seeing less annuals, less bare ground, and maybe a regeneration of some species that we weren't seeing before. You know, we have some pastures that I remember 15 years ago that were down on especially near riparian areas that were more heavily grazed, that were fairly high in annuals, a lot of cheatgrass. And, you know, some of these, I can think of one pasture, for instance, that was probably, 60% cheatgrass. It's now 25 or 30% in those key areas. So we're still working on it, but we're seeing big blue stem come back. We never used to see big blue stem. We're real cool season dominated in the area. So we're getting more species diversity. And I think that that's one thing, the rotational grazing, that is certainly worth considering. And there's a little bit of upfront cost with some of it and putting in some cross fence, developing water to do that. And, I know in Western South Dakota is the same as, out here in Eastern Wyoming, Southern Montana, water is usually our first limiting nutrient. And so, combining that concept with what I talked about earlier of finding areas that may be more suitable for fall or winter grazing, where the water is not as good, and then utilizing this rotational grazing has allowed us to be able to make improvements in our range resource, which is very, very important for a lot of reasons, and does have impacts on the bottom line. But I think has some it's really the right thing to do and the right message for us to send in the industry. So that's been kind of fun to watch that progression over time. And it does take time. It's not something that you just, you do it for a couple of years and you're like, oh my gosh, this is a world of difference. It takes time depending on how intensive you are. So anyways, those are a couple things, Robin, that come to mind, that have been pretty successful for us.
Ask you a question, Trey, in regards
go ahead.
To changing it to a May, June, calving, systems. Obviously you had a change in when you marketed, and granted you guys are able to run yearlings. You have a grower yard. How did that influence you guys that first year you guys started doing that? I mean, there was obviously an impact on you guys, and as producers are considering doing that May, June calving season, which more and more are actually converting to that, but there's always that concern of, okay, I have these lighter calves. And I always traditionally, and the word tradition is in there, sell in the fall of the year. And how do I offset those lighter calves? So is there anything on a management side or what you guys have noticed when you were, or when visiting with other producers?
Well, for us, that transition was pretty easy because we had the ability to background those cattle and carry them over, and add weight to them. So weaning weight's really not something that we're that concerned about. We're concerned about sell weights. And don't get me wrong, I do understand we do sell weight in our industry. But you also have to realize that sometimes those lighter calves, even if you're selling in the fall, they're worth more dollars per pound. And so in our system, we've been able to, they'll compensate some big part of that weight difference on the silage rations during the fall and winter time. And so we're still able to sell that weight. But I have worked with and am familiar with some other operations that have moved that season back that do sell calves in the fall of the year. And they have not seen a big hit on the revenue side. They've seen that cost savings that I talked about, but they've worked pretty hard in establishing a market for those lightweight calves. And lightweight calves, buyers, as long as they're healthy and they're weaned, and they don't have to deal with a bunch of health issues and death loss on them, they're fun to feed because they're really efficient. You're still putting on a lot of bone and muscle. That's fairly efficient gains. That's more efficient than putting on fat. So you can add weight to them, fairly economically. And so I think there are many buyers that are willing to add, pay more for those lightweight calves because they feed really well. They can own them a little longer and cheap that initial investment back if their cost of gains are less than the market. So I think that is a certainly an issue, and it's something to be considered, but you have to weigh that against the cost. And so, and there's market data available. You can say, well, I normally sell 6 weight calves in the fall, and these may be 5 weight calves in the fall, or five and a quarter weight calves or whatever. What is the net, what is the revenue difference? Not just the if you look at the price being higher on that lighter weight, there may be, and probably is, sometimes you look at that and say, well, you know, gross revenue is a little bit less, but when you put those cost savings on it, net income may actually be higher.
Hey, thanks, Trey, for sharing that.
Yeah, you bet. And we've got by, even with these May calves, we've got by really well and weaning them early when we had to, because we're pretty fire prone out here, and it's not uncommon for us to get some fairly large fires that can take out substantial areas of rangeland. But we've weaned Mayborn calves in August before, and they're light, they're little bitty buggers. That's really earlier than you want to, but the little buggers go on feed and they wean really, really well. In fact, I think they wean easier than some of the bigger, soggier calves that we wean later in the year. So it does not necessarily take that, management flexibility away from you. You know, but speaking of the fire situation, you ask about maybe some things we learned. One of the things that we were doing for quite some time was, we identified, we had one fairly large unit of a ranch and said, water is a problem here. It's our first limiting nutrient. The water that's there has got quite a bit of sulfur in it, sulfate issues, which we dealt with a lot in Western South Dakota when I was there. And so we said, we'll just stock this really, really light in the summertime and winter, a whole pile of cows there. And so we left that unit basically ungrazed. Now there's a couple interesting points with that. One is that the growing season every year, that rangeland looks really good. I mean, if you get rain, you've got all that feed set in there, got a lot of activity on the soil, and it sometimes looks like a game preserve the time you turn in there. And our winter grazing, it's worked really well. There's still quite a bit of quality in it. But there's some unintended consequences of doing that over and over and over, I believe. One of the things that we saw with that system was we saw annuals starting to creep up. You say, well, that doesn't make any sense. You're deferring, you're resting these pastures through the entire growing season. And I just talked about a while ago how important I think that is to rest them. But if they're never getting an early season grazing, you do have a lot of litter on the soil, which is good. Litter's good. I mean, you got warmer soil temperatures in the spring, maybe an earlier start to your growing season because of the soil temps, more bug activity and so on at the soil surface. And that's good, but too much litter and no early season grazing, I think, makes a pretty dang good seed bed for these annuals. It gives them a chance to get rooted in. And we actually saw, annuals creeping up in some of those pastures that had been repetitively deferred until, after the growing season. The other thing that we saw with that is when we had pretty large landscapes that were left ungrazed, that fuel load was at risk to burning down with fire or being taken out by grasshoppers. And so if you're going to winter graze, you obviously need to defer some pastures. But I think our thinking has changed. Is that something I can say? I think our thinking's changed. It has changed, and we want to create more of a mosaic. And so we're still deferring pastures for winter grazing. But we've changed our mindset a little bit on how that's accomplished. If we can come in and graze some of those pastures early, every third year or so, we feel like that early season grazing is good to help with the annual management. But it also kind of creates a mosaic on the landscape that if we do get fires, that we've got some areas where we can control them. Because if you've got all these pastures that are deferred on a good moisture year, believe me, we didn't have to worry about too much the last couple of years, but on a good moisture year, the fuel load is so high, we couldn't stop the fires. And so if we had a fire, it was a big one and it burned a lot of country. And then we had a few years where grasshoppers came in during the summer and took some of that feed base out, and a few where it's some of that feed base got snowed in. Cows are a lot better than we give them credit for at getting through snow and grazing. But, you know, we had a few years that we'd get 18 inches of snow on the level and it'd warm up a little bit and then it'd get icy and it flat snowed it in. So you, on a whole landscape level, we were putting all that resource in that particular area at some risk. And so we are still deferring pastures, but we're trying not to do that all in the same area and all at the same time to try to manage some of that. So that's been a learning curve for us.
Trey, I think you bring up a really good point there, especially with some of that stuff that you guys are doing in such a strategic way, targeting some of those plants early on in the year to give some of those more, I guess, ideal perennials a chance to get a better foot in those pastures. I remember working early on in my agricultural lifetime for a city-owned property between Cheyenne and Laramie, Wyoming, and them having to come in the middle of those summers and kind of like you were talking about there, that litter load was so accumulated due to deferred grazing that they were having to mow fire breaks to prevent those fires from getting out of control should one occur. And then coming in later in the year and managing what they could out of those plant communities through yearling mob grazing. And at that point, those plant communities were already, I'm sure, decreasing in quality. And there was a lot more advanced grazing strategies that probably could have been employed to avoid a lot of those costs and hauling machinery up the mountain to mow fire breaks, when in reality, that was the whole point of putting yearlings out there in the first place, was to have them harvest that forage. So I think it's a really good point that you bring up and maybe mixing it up to advance those plant communities for the long term.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have to be really effective at management. We have to learn to be systems thinkers. And that is looking at the distal relationships, spatial and distal relationships between cause and effect. And, you know, we're just the way our minds work by nature and the way we're trained in conventional education systems is we think everything's linear. And we have fairly short memories. And so we have to train ourselves to kind of look long-term and look at some of the unintended consequences of what we're doing and really identify what the principles are of good management. And so we know that resting pastures, that principle has been proven, it works. But in a systems thinking, you're looking at that from the impact of all those things we've been talking about, from, you know, fire management to risk of losing your resource to how it impacts your animal performance and your marketing program and so on. And there's just a lot of things to consider there. And I'm afraid too many times, though, we use that as an excuse to say, well, dang, this is complicated. I don't think I want to change anything. And that's really dangerous, too. I mean, you look at the businesses that, you know, once they become mature and, you know, you're kind of done growing and you've got a status quo in the business world, that's a danger sign that you could be heading towards a slow death. And so we want to be innovating and we want to be trying new things and doing things differently. But you have to really think about some of those consequences and just be monitoring it. And you have to realize that when we make changes in our production system, there will be unintended consequences, things that we didn't think about before. So monitor that, understand it, and manage it appropriately. And, you know, I think about a football program, for instance, that recruits a young man to be a quarterback, highly touted recruit, say in college football, and turns out that it's not working out like they thought it should. You know, that person that maybe plays there a couple years, the team's not doing very good. Maybe it's the leadership, maybe the athletic ability wasn't there, decision making, whatever. But I've sat and watched football coaches that wouldn't let their ego make a change. And because they made a decision, they're like, well, I'm going to make this right. And you double down on a bad decision. And so a lot of it is understanding what decisions we make are bad and not double downing on them. Don't look back too far and beat yourself up. Look back and say, man, that didn't work out quite like I thought, but I've learned from it. And now I'm going to shift directions again. Maybe that's just a very slight shift. Maybe it's just some intervention. But we can't be afraid to try some new things and do different things and learn from it and then make adjustments as we learn. We're always learning here. We manage very complex biological systems. We manage a complicated marketing, commodity marketing scenario. Labor is a constant challenge. And we have to be making adjustments, you know, to our systems as we go on. And I think that's really the difference in your top tier producers and those that are in the bottom tier of profitability, is that people have learned how to reinvent themselves a little bit and really think out of the box. Now, a lot of times those are not huge changes. Sometimes they are, but I don't think we have to just accept that, you know, the cow-calf industry is, you know, over a 10-year average over the course of a cattle cycle is a break-even business. There are people making money at it. And I think we've been able to show that you can do this, you can do it successfully. But you've got to be able to make some changes. And like I say, learn. We're just always learning and filing those things we learn in our back in our memory. And we spend a lot of time, you know, analyzing scenarios and looking at data, looking at information to try to understand, you know, what's working and what's not. You know, I can give you maybe a fairly simple example of that. Here a few years back, we had a really dry summer and pregnancy rates were quite a bit lower than normal, than I thought they should, than probably they should have been. Okay. And so you look at that and you start thinking, well, dang, maybe I should have fed more last winter. Maybe I should have spent more money on supplements or feeding programs, or maybe I should have destocked more or whatever. But in further evaluation of the data, the running age cows had as high of a breed up as they ever had. It was in some older cows, you know, 9 years and older, 10-year-old cows and older that we had in the system that really struggled in that dry summer. But what do you learn from that? Throwing feed at the whole system would have wasted feed for the lion's share of the cattle on the ranch. But maybe what we learned is, boy, on those kind of years, those older cows may need a little more TLC. And so you strategically allocate those inputs to those age groups. Maybe it's your 2-year-old cows. In a lot of systems, that might be the, you know, the 2- and 3-year-old cows is where the issue's at. But by looking at the data that way, you know, you're able to really make better decisions and think about it somewhat more from a system standpoint than the whole ranch system in general.
Yeah, I think you bring up some really, really good points there about how it's just so, so crucial for us in this industry to constantly have our finger on the pulse of what's going on throughout the entire operation and be able to constantly adapt and evolve and kind of move on the fly with a lot of these things. You know, I love that quote by Albert Einstein that once you stop learning, that's when you start dying. And I think that really says a lot about how progressive we really have to be to stay relevant and stay at the top of this, at the top of this industry. And, you know, maybe this is a great time to transition back to the female side of things a little bit. And maybe you can tie some of that together with how you guys thinking about how things are going to have to be managed down the road in terms of forage availability in your forage base, how you guys make the decision to allocate some of that to your heifers and how that frees you up to take care of some of those younger cows, perhaps that are going to need some more feed resources as they go through the winter.
Thank you to Kiernan for providing a great question to kick off the next episode of Cattle HQ. So we'll be ending our conversation with Trey for this podcast. But join us for our next episode as Trey shares how the Padlock Ranch manages their heifers, young females, with the forage resources they have. Thank you to Trey for joining us from the Padlock Ranch in Ranchester, Wyoming. And thank you for listening to Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information. Until our next episode with Trey, the best way to improve your looks is to wear a smile.